Another episode of In the Know. Tonight we're going to be talking about an issue that's actually been talked about for quite a while now. We're going to be talking about local efforts regarding gun violence. We've seen in the newspaper that there have been shootings recently. I think the question on everybody's mind is, how do we protect our families? How do we protect our neighborhoods? That's always the kind of the million-dollar question, because this is something that we're starting to see more of rather than less of. And there's always the question of, what is local law enforcement doing? What are other efforts that are being done? Because I think sometimes we're not always aware of what those efforts are. In the studio with me tonight is Karen Crawford Sims. She's involved with the Community Coalition, but I'll also let her give a little bit more of her background as well. And she can tell you what we're going to be talking tonight about, other efforts that are being made in the community. So Karen, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you, Sherry. And I'm sure I'm so sorry I'm running late.
Tell us a little bit about your background and what got you involved specifically with community violence, because you also do trauma-informed care, but it looks like we're starting to prioritize community violence because we're seeing more of it now, unfortunately.
So we see the work between the trauma work and the community violence response work. In some ways, we see them interconnected, but the question you ask, how I got involved with the community violence work. We always, I think, as a part of the trauma initiative, have always wanted to make a difference. One of the first things that Tracy Parsons brought to the trauma group 3 years ago when we first started working was his concern about that actually came from law enforcement, that when law enforcement were coming on the scene, they were seeing more and more youth playing in the street within hours after an incident of gun violence, or having people seem unaffected by the incidents of gun violence. So he, from the beginning, said, hey, I want to make sure that we think about having a vibrant response that sort of looks like how our community responds after disaster or natural disasters or other things like that. And so we've informally done some work as a part of the trauma group. We call it CU Neighborhood Champions. So our champion responders have sort of been working informally and then behind the scenes supporting some families that have been impacted by gun violence. And there have been other initiatives like Truce and Moms Who Are All have been working,
Moms Demand Action.
Yeah. So a number of initiatives have sort of been working together, the Ministerial Alliance. And what we decided to do was to turn it into a much more vibrant, dynamic, coordinated response team, sort of aware of where the hiccups have been and what has been challenging about trying to work together in a way that's meaningful and effective. So the short answer is, I've been doing this work for a minute, but have always seen sort of pathways between the trauma work and the violence response work is interconnected, because right, the research is pretty compelling. Not addressing many of the people who become shooters have unresolved, unaddressed prior traumas. So it frequently becomes a maladaptive response to dealing with sort of complex needs in communities that don't have people who respond to incidents of trauma, become re-traumatizing to the communities, and they're also less resilient. So part of this is all interconnected.
Yeah, I think that's the question that, comes up so much in all of these conversations is, what are the root causes? Why are these things happening? And I think, we go to the easy blame, and then we start playing the race card that it's just a certain population that is responsible for this type of behavior. But I think the one piece that has been previously left out quite a bit is the mental health piece and that trauma piece, because I think people they like to qualify trauma. They like to qualify people's experiences, and they also feel like it's as simple as just, the saying has always been, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and just figure out a way to stop this. But this is generational. This is cyclical. Mm-hmm. The trauma definitely can be passed down, and, you have experiences where it's becoming more common. Like, even though it is trauma and it is commonplace in some ways, people feel like you should be addressing this as a community, but how do people do that without the appropriate resources, the appropriate support? And I think that's where we keep missing the mark when we're trying to heal as a community, is that we have to heal as a community. Like you, I think there's a phrase you've used that we suffer as a community, but we also have to heal as a community.
Absolutely.
And so, one of the things I've seen, which speaks to what you were saying, and it's really unfortunate, is that, working in Urbana High School and talking to students, this is par for the course for them. It is traumatizing. I don't think the students even recognize that's what they're experiencing, but to say that they're used to it is so hard to hear. When there was a shooting at Central High School and they interviewed one of the students, she basically echoed the same thing, that this isn't anything new for us. And so when we talk about the root problems, you talked about how there's trauma that's not addressed. Do you think that's where we really need to start? Because, people want to know where they put their efforts.
Yeah. So, right, complicated problems come with complicated solutions, right? So, but I want to say a couple of things that's right. So I'm trying to figure out where to start. But one of the things that you said is we as a community, we as individuals frequently don't think about root causes of where community violence comes from, right? And it's complicated, right? We know it's a combination between access to weapons. So there's some gun issues and some community norms issues. There's some mental health or unresolved trauma. So how people respond to stressors, what do people do when they're angry? How do they regulate affect? How do they deal with stress, right? Mm-hmm. So root cause that comes, right? Unfortunately, that comes from the physiological piece. How do we deal with structural inequities, which is just a fancy word to talk about racism? And so not the race card. I don't think about race card. I think about the racism card, because we know that when communities are under-resourced with like jobs and opportunity and food, right? Like natural good food and all the things that help promote resiliency and healing and wellness, that those become breeding grounds. So there's a correlation between communities that don't have resources and opportunity and hope and increased rates of violence. And right, and so, and we would also think about schools as a part of that, things that are resiliency building. And so, right, there is a gun issue. Access and norms around guns. There are some interpersonal, individual issues that are all trauma related. And then there are the structural inequities and structural barriers that are unfortunately race related that frequently create environments that aren't protective, that that are deficit based, that aren't resiliency based, that aren't protective, and don't provide the access for opportunities for both youth and parents, because we often forget about the adults in those communities. And so, really, I think it's a community, as you said this, we need a community-wide approach where that we're looking at both law enforcement and community safety and community. We're also looking at community norms. We're also making sure that families have strong networks of support and the resources they need, that we're also thinking about where do we address structural inequality. And you will see the more violent, the more structural inequality right, look at the poverty numbers. As poverty numbers increase, as people's access to jobs decrease, unfortunately, in most communities, there tends to be a correlation between those things and increased rates of community violence, right? It becomes this sort of toxic soup. So we got to do, unfortunately, people want to like be like, oh, I'm going to create like maybe an after-school program, or maybe I want to think about jobs for reentry, or maybe it's I want to do gun safety, or maybe, and it really is, yeah, it all needs to be happening, and it all needs to be happening in a way that's much more targeted and coordinated. And we got to stop, sort of putting band-aids on things and really sort of trying to challenge things in a much more concrete way.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have seen is it's not that there haven't been efforts that have been made, but the sustainability of them, mm-hmm. I think we're starting to lack that. And it's hard to say that... it's hard to tell what's going to be what's going to work, what's going to be successful if we see programs that fizzle out after a couple of years. Mm-hmm. You know, it really takes long-term effort to be able to have the numbers and the results to show, is this working? Is this what we need to be doing? You know, one of the things that I think we talk so much about, but then we kind of drop the ball, is early intervention. Mm-hmm. You know, we have so many, there's plenty of research that talks about early intervention in a myriad of different things, whether it's health, whether it's education. But that, I think you're right, we focus on the child, which is great, but we forget about what the parents need. Because this is, you know, I've tried to explain this to people, that what you're asking for is essentially for people to start speaking an entirely new language. This is the language they grew up with. This is no fault of their own. This is just what they thought was normal. And in order for them to have a healthier language, we have to be able to provide that for them. And we have to have support for that. And we have to be able to sustain that in a healthy way. And, you know, sometimes I think we move so far away from what we should be doing, which is really connecting with those people who are saying we want help, you know, regardless of who it is. They say they want help. What is it they want help with? Why are we always thinking that we know what other people need? And I think that's another place where we need to start, because when people feel heard, they feel empowered, they feel confident in making change, rather than, oh, well, we know exactly what you need. We know what your children need. And I think that's another miss that we have quite frequently.
So yes, I think as you articulated, frequently people believe and have this mythology that I'm going to start again. So one of the things that you said was, we don't talk about earlier intervention. We also don't talk about prevention. So if you think about from a health perspective, we don't think about, like, how do we make sure that these things don't ever become problems, right? So, like, if we were going to think about prevention to make sure that folks, adults, young people, teenagers, young adults, live in communities that promote their well-being, health, and safety, right, across the board, well, what would that look like? Let's mm-hmm. imagine some of that, those, what that would look like. We have parents meaningfully involved in their communities, and we would have multiple opportunities for that. And they probably would have some say. They probably would say that there would probably be, again, more parent involvement opportunities. There would be, their voices would be included, so it wouldn't be just like I attend a meeting. It would be like I would have a say in the things that happen to my children and to me. It would be maybe even more green spaces, or maybe a grocery store would be within walking distance to most communities, right? Like, it would be different if we were thinking real wellness as opposed to even intervention, because in early intervention means I see something is going wrong. But imagine in a world where we believe, as you said, parents know best, people and neighbors know best, a community knows best what it needs. And if we create those opportunities for people to tell us, we might transform them rather than people meeting outside of a community and then coming up with a great idea that they impose. I mean, I don't mean that negatively, but it's sort of like, we think we know what you need, and so we created like a whatever it is for you, and we anticipate that there is a benefit. So, right, part one. And then the other thing I was thinking about is, so so we've talked a little bit in training, for those people who've ever been to a training or heard things around trauma. Increasingly, people are looking at the ACEs pyramid. Mm-hmm. So for people who don't know, the ACEs is the Adverse Childhood Experiences. And there's a pyramid that shows how adverse childhood experiences kind of lead to some adverse health outcomes, right? And so they, and increasingly, they've been modifying that pyramid, and they call it Racing ACEs. And the reason why they call it Racing ACEs is because they add another layer where you look at historical and generational trauma, and they say, like, if you don't pay attention to the historical and generational trauma, as sort of the soil that leads to other ACEs for a number of people, then you miss part of the conversation. So I'm going to go back to something that you said around adaptive responses, and so I'm going to be really so your audience can appreciate this. But imagine if I grew up in slavery, hypothetically, right? There are adaptive responses in terms of how I would raise my children that would make absolute sense for slavery. So one of those adaptive responses is there were penalties for folks who were literate and who read. And so there were parents who raised their kids to in some ways minimize smarts and intelligence, right? Because that became sort of a stigma, and it could also get you killed or have a foot amputated or have your tongue cut out or all kinds of horrific kinds of things. So then you could develop sort of structural issues around literacy and learning and engagement. And then those same folks, not so long ago, because it was during my mom's generation, then were people who grew up where literacy and learning was poo-pooed on, but some people persevered and pressed through, but other people were really persecuted for learning and literacy, who then had to go into schools. They had became a part of efforts to desegregate. And they encountered structural and institutional barriers that said, we don't really value your presence, we don't value your learning, we don't value your literacy. And so those folks raise kids who might also have some traumas around education and that come, right, that are 200 years old. So yes, there could be lots of efforts on prevention and early intervention to get people engaged in school and engaged in learning, which we know is helpful. But if we don't talk about some of the root causes of where some of those fears around learning and literacy and some of people's experiences with those oppressive institutions are, then we miss part of the conversation, right? So we could deal with the symptoms where people don't necessarily, where people might have stigmas and internalized issues around being a scholar and being learned and being whatever. And people will, right, dance around why that might be without thinking about, it would make sense that maybe a lot of folks might have a mixed bag of relationships with school if you don't think about sort of the whole story, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we could think about all adaptive responses that people have regarding trauma. Like we go back to thinking about how did that survival skill make sense during that context? Where did it come from? And so maybe it's not our survival skill that makes sense universally, but maybe in your neighborhood being hypervigilant makes sense. Or maybe being more defensive in certain situations where you've grew up with lots of abusers and so you decided you weren't gonna let people sort of push you around. So maybe you seem much more angry and much more volatile. It's not like it makes sense within that adaptive, right, that reality. And so we will say, that's not learned behavior, correct behavior. But no, it absolutely is correct behavior for that audience, for that environment, for that experience. What we do need to do is create more environments where you don't have to be on guard all the time, or to help people who are working with you understand where it comes from, and then to sort of, right, broaden the opportunities for people not to sort of stay in those traumatic, sort of moving in the world from their traumas, but we have to provide more safe spaces for that to happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember having a conversation with one of the principals in Unit 4 who had gone out to do a visit because the male student had been gone for, I think, 21 days of the first quarter, and it was just, you know, why is the student not here? They live right around the corner. They could walk. And so when the principal sat down with the mother basically said, education didn't do anything for me. Nobody in that building ever supported me when I was going through school. And having a high school diploma hasn't helped me since then. And so, again, you know, unless you're experiencing this, it's hard, like you said, to understand why these behaviors are here. I studied under a professor in the College of Education, and she wrote a book. It was Dr. Sandra Rice Murray Nettles, and she wrote a book called Necessary Spaces. Mm-hmm. Very easy read, but so impactful because it really talks about these spaces that we grow up in and how integral they are to who we see ourselves as. And she talks about, you know, the space where they would have dinner, you know, once a week. She would talk about how there was a park, though, that they weren't really allowed to go mm-hmm. to because they were Black children, and how that affects you as a person and your identity of, well, why am I not allowed in that park? And it was just, it's amazing because people take for granted. I mean, we hear that phrase all the time. People take for granted the access they have, the privilege that they have. They may not define it that way mm-hmm. because it's just common, it's standard in their life. But imagine if you were, you know, a white person and you went to Westside Park and all of a sudden somebody said, nope, this park isn't for you, sorry. Yeah. Half the town would be up in arms about it. Probably more than that. Because again, who are you to define what my access is? But that's really what we've seen over the centuries, is a group of people defining for another group of people what their access and privilege is. And it's kind of hard for people to understand unless they're growing up in that. And I think it's also hard for people to understand when we want to qualify trauma. Well, that's not traumatic to me. Yeah. But you probably have resources. Mm. I know one of the examples that you gave was, you know, if you have two people who are in the exact same car accident and one person has support, has health insurance, has car insurance, has all sorts of different things, the other person has maybe half of that. That determines how they recover from that. Mm. And trauma is no different. If you don't have an appropriate support system, which can look a lot of different ways, you know, again, you don't know what it's like to suffer through that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the one thing that we continue to it's just so easy to qualify other people's mm-hmm. pain. And that's something that's kind of frustrating because, again, when we're looking at gun violence, it still just goes back to it's one person's problem. It's one demographic that we're looking at, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I sort of talked pretty cerebrally about sort of the macro issues related to trauma, you know, but we are trying to land the plane and think about concrete things that we can do to sort of build the plane while flying it, right? So to improve our community's ability to respond to people in a way that is both preventative and supportive, that helps promote and resiliency building, that helps promote some recovery. So we are trying to think about that and building that infrastructure.
I mean, there are a lot of, I think the other thing is we want to believe it's just kind of one cure out there, one organization, one agency mm-hmm. that's going to fix all of this. But the reality is it takes every single mm-hmm. agency Absolutely. And every single organization in existence right now to help that, because while there are some research will prove that some things are somewhat uniform, you still are dealing with people yeah. and their needs are different. But, you know, determining, dependent on where they came from, are they from this community? You know, there's a lot of different things. One of the plugs I like to give is Sistering CU is a group that goes out for new mothers. Mm-hmm. And how amazing is that, especially if you're a younger mother? When I had my oldest daughter, I was 26, so I wasn't young, but I didn't have my own mother. And I remember when I brought her home from the hospital, I looked at my dad and I'm like, what am I supposed to do with her? So those kind of programs are absolutely amazing, because really every mom can use support. And I think we are also in a place where some doctors, I think, are good about it, but really recognizing that postpartum depression, because it's a spectrum again. You don't have to be on a ledge somewhere to be experiencing postpartum depression. It can just be very subtle things through the day that can tank you a little bit. And so I think it's great that we have this organization that says, you know, for 12 weeks we'll come out and we'll support you the best that we can. So, you know, when people think about how do I get involved, pick your organization. All of them can do something integral for our families here in the community. So as far as what the coalition is doing, I know we have a walk coming up in a couple of days. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, great lead. So we are having a Walk as One event. So the coalition, you know, sponsors these community walks periodically. And this walk was actually planned before we had these recent incidents of violence. So the walk is in the historical North End, which is the area between Park Street and Bradley. So it's really the area around Douglas Park all the way over to King School. We're meeting at Salem Missionary Baptist Church. The walk will start at 5. It'll go until 6:30. And really, it's a chance for the community to come out and say, A, we see you and we want to support you and we are a part of your community and we are neighbors. So that's part one, you know, to say, hey, we're here too. Part two of the walk is to make sure that people in neighborhoods are aware of some of the summer program activities and some of the things to do the summer for kids, because we know that that's a protective factor. And when kids are busy, they do better. And we also want to make sure that parents also have some information. And we'll also, thinking about other messages, have a few resources around gun violence prevention and gun safety. So it has a threefold approach, right? So it's, hey, know that the community is supporting you and is there for you and it's connected, and we see ourselves as connected to you. We want to make sure that you're aware of as many resources that are available. You choose to support your family, your child, as many resiliency building activities as possible. And third is we want to make sure that you have some basic information that might be helpful around gun safety, and so that you and your family can be safe. Mm-hmm. So those are the approaches. We will also be providing just a little bit of initial information too about our upcoming community violence messaging forums. So we'll begin to introduce the idea to the community, just because we want people to know that after an incident of gun violence that they can expect to at least have a place to go in a way that's targeted and coordinated to get some information, to understand kind of what's being done to keep them safe, but also to sort of introduce them to, or to provide a space so that they can talk about what to look for, what might be potential mental health needs, where they might go to get other kinds of supports, how to engage and how to engage in those supports.
Mm-hmm. So what type of efforts are being made in the aftermath of these types of situations? Because that, you know, from what I saw at Urbana High School, you know, fights were happening as a retaliatory approach to what happened over the summer, with a certain youth being killed. And so, you know, it's really, you know, remiss to think that that's not necessary, especially with our youth, because again, they don't always understand what they're experiencing, but they know that there's a feeling that just won't go away. And, you know, that's how one of my students described it. He was saying, you know, there's just this feeling that started growing in me after it happened. And he said, it's not like I hate anybody, but I just like everything around me. And he's trying to verbalize as best he can what he's experiencing. So I think it's incredibly important that we're providing this, again, not just for the youth, but also for the parents, helping them have the language to support and sustain that after these types of events.
So yes. and so, again, one of the points of the messaging forums, which is not quite the first question you asked, but one of the points of the messaging forums is to get families more information, families and community members more information about what to look for, what could be potential signs and symptoms, what are typical responses after incidents of gun violence that parents might be able to look for. We have the National Child Traumatic Stress Network has this great checklist called In Dangerous Times, and last summer we were out in the community talking to having young people fill it out, and it asks sort of them to identify some potential, how they might be responding or impacted by community violence. And it was amazing. There are like 12 elements on it, like that might be typical reactions, and how many young people stopped at a table at an event, completed, just checked off the list, and told us how many of the symptoms the adverse experience, how they were being adversely impacted by the community violence around them. And so, yes, we want young people to be aware that those are adverse experiences and be able to verbalize that, but also to think about, like, and then what does that mean? Like, where is it that you can go for help? What is it that you can do for yourself? Where are those, fortunately, there are some really good things that are available on the web. There's some really crappy things, but there are mm-hmm. some really great things, like a Calm app or all those kinds of things that are self-support strategies. We want people to know that where is it that you can do. But also, like, if you need something else, how do you know when you're moving from just sort of needing self-support strategies or support strategies from when you might need, like, a person to talk to, and how to know what to look for from that person to talk to, because every therapist isn't the right therapist if you've experienced trauma. And for young people, particularly young people who are under a certain age, you know, so might need some more physical-based and body-based therapies and more movement-based therapeutic interventions. And so how do you have parents understand what to be at? You know, if you don't know the right questions to ask, you just make a call and say, my kid needs therapy and somebody to talk to, and then they go to that therapy and it may not get the benefit because it's not the right fix. You know, I always say this, it's like giving somebody diabetes medicine to treat their hypertension, and we wonder, like, why isn't it getting better? Well, right. They're both meds, but they're not treating the right thing in the right way, and so you just won't necessarily see the benefit. So we want families to be much more empowered with what they can do. And mm-hmm. the other thing, and so I talk about it from a mental health perspective, but the other thing that we know that what helps promote resiliency is getting your power back. Mm-hmm. So if you've been violated and you feel powerless for a whole bunch of different reasons, it just reinforces your trauma. And so we want communities to know that this is what you can do. There are some things, you know, even if it's something like a neighborhood watch, that you can do to start reclaiming your power. So maybe it's your community that wants to have regular cookouts or block parties, or maybe it's a community where you just sort of do, as Herbert Burnett says, not on my watch, like these three blocks, certain behaviors just won't be allowed. Or as neighbors, there are a lot of things that you can do to restore a sense of safety and community norms. But I think sometimes when you're feeling like it's just coming from all sides, you forget that there are some small things that you could do that really could make a difference.
Yeah, one of the things that I did at Urbana High School was I would do mindfulness work in the mm-hmm. classrooms. And some of the students, you know, they kind of felt like, well, this is really hokey. Mm-hmm. But they would get up and they would do stretches and we would do breathing exercises. And some would say it, some wouldn't, but you could tell there was a difference. Mm-hmm. They were at least for that moment relaxed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was in one classroom where we had done that and I said, so how do you feel? And they're like, we actually feel, you know, better. Like, absolutely. And then that led to the conversation where one student said, you know, I feel angry all the time. Mm-hmm. And so now we get into this discussion about what you're really feeling, what you're bringing into the school. Because it's so difficult, I think, when people are taking this look from the outside in at a dynamic in a school, what they're missing is, what is that child bringing to mm-hmm. school? You know, what do these parents even need, I think, this moment to restore themselves, mm-hmm. to have that mindfulness, to be able to create a better baseline for themselves? Because when you do live in neighborhoods where there is a high risk of violence or just other activity, I feel like you're always on edge. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to make decisions when you're always on edge. And it's, I think it's also hard to feel like you're making the best decisions, because it's almost like it's like rapid response. Like you have to fire off these decisions like right away. And so I think we need to figure out ways for our adults who are doing so many things. You know, we have grandmothers caring for children. We have everybody doing more. And I think we need to find ways to give them an opportunity to restore themselves, because you can't, like they say, you can't pour from an empty cup.
And no incident of violence. So every incident of violence is meaningful and significant and disruptive and impactful and sad and just awful. So I want to own that. I also know that based on data, not on just our own subjective experiences, that things feel bad, but they're not the worst that they've been. So that's the reality, just based on the numbers, and not minimizing people's experience of the numbers, because, right, we have this very media savvy, but during the middle of the crack and cocaine epidemic, those were the highest numbers, incidents of gun violence. I mean, like 2 to 3 times greater than what we're seeing currently. These are the children, the adults are the children of those folks who lived through that and had people not respond to them. So I know it feels like a lot, but one of the reasons why I mention that is we're not having, knock on wood or any substance, right, if you believe superstitious, one of the things that makes people's experience of community violence locally so challenging is that it is an uneven thing. It's not, we can go for weeks where there's not something and then all of a sudden everything will blow up. Well, what we know from a psychology perspective is when things are uneven and unexpected, that actually makes it harder for us to manage psychologically, because we don't know when it's happening. We don't know where it will happen. It's not like we can say, we need the world to be consistent, predictable, and safe. So we can't say, oh, in the 400 block of X Street, there's probably going to be a shooting on Tuesday at 4. Mm-hmm. If people knew that, then people would be like, oh, so when I'm around X Street Tuesdays at 4, there's a shooting. Instead, it's popping up like popcorn, and popcorn that gets popped at different times in day, which is, I think, what makes recovery and planning and why people are so hypervigilant, is because there's such a randomness to this. Our community violence, and I share this, is not like communities that have huge incidents of violence that are related to drug-related issues. Because again, those have patterns, they have themes, there are ways that you can figure out what's happening. Instead, our community violence, it's very intermittent. It seems to be very interpersonal. It tends to be folks not having good affect regulation skills. So it doesn't have the kinds of things that make it easier for you to manage, because there's so much unpredictability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where, again, that experience, if you haven't experienced it, you don't understand what that's like.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are certain parts of our community where I'm sure they would never expect anything to happen in their neighborhood. They can just easily come home after work, enjoy their family, and feel safe in their home and their neighborhood. And so, you know, I always felt, you know, raising my children, that you have to be able to combat these stereotypes and notions by having your family experience it. So, no, I'm not obviously taking my children into, you know, the battlefield per se, but I wanted my oldest daughter to come volunteer with me and understand that you don't have to experience it to be able to, you know, sympathize with what's going on. And so, you know, I've had parents over the years contact me and say, you know, my kid is growing up in this generation where empathy is lacking. And so how do I get them to connect with that? Take your children to volunteer. You know, when we talk about early intervention, that's what we should be focusing on, is being able to instill that in your student so that, you know, when something does come up, they also feel empowered. I think empowering our students, because I said it on somebody's Facebook page, I said if they're old enough to experience it, they're old enough to have a voice, mm-hmm. to say how they should go in the future. And so I think we need to also do more with empowering our youth, because like you said, you know, when you were talking about the epidemic, the children of those who survived that are now our adults. So if we want to start breaking cycles, we have to be able to intervene in there. So what types of things does the coalition have going on for the youth this summer?
You know, I don't have 100% of those answers, in part because, first of all, notifications around funding haven't happened. And so the summer programming is contingent upon receiving Mental Health Board funding. And I think that information comes out within the next couple of weeks. I actually think the same day that we have our Walk is One event, which I forgot to say, is on Trauma-Informed Care Awareness Day. I think the Mental Health Board is having a study session where they're going to talk about awards. And so I can't talk about some of the really innovative community-based practices that have existed in other summers. So I know that the coalition, not necessarily through the same pot of money that the Mental Health Board funds, but through other collaborative resources, supports summer jobs and summer employment, both in Champaign and Urbana. But the summer programming from things like midnight basketball, there's been a fishing program, there have been sports and athletic programs. I mean, really, it's been thinking holistically about the needs of youth and also providing a lot of different opportunities, because some kids who would really love midnight basketball might be a different subset of kids who are interested in something like fishing or golf, or maybe a theater program, or may want to be involved in something else. And so the coalition looks for community partners to provide a range of those culturally responsive, community-based activities that are resiliency building broad and deep for youth. But I think it's all contingent on, you know, what happens with funding. So know that, you know, so we were talking a little bit, you mentioned this sort of off parenthetically, but the community needs to realize that, yes, we want you to volunteer, but also there are decisions that you make with your dollars, or how you prioritize tax dollars, or what you vote on, or all of those things that also communicate something mm-hmm. about your investment in communities. So to pay attention to, you know, when you're saying yes to something or no to something, and kids not only listen to what we say, but also what we do. And so if we're in the house and we're talking about how we are, you know, we want to not give or participate or contribute to the betterment of neighborhoods that aren't our own, it doesn't matter how generous we say that you should be, if really all the things that you verbalize say, I only care about things that happen in my six blocks, and I don't care about investing in resources in the rest of the six blocks. And if we want to be fair, some communities, for lots of really important reasons, need a few more resources just to sort of make sure that things are equitable. That would benefit us all, but sometimes it requires a little bit more investment, and we just, all of us, need to be just sort of much more conscious about how we're utilizing our resources and how we're investing and what we're prioritizing, because it all makes a difference.
Yeah, I think the other thing we sometimes lose sight of is we want to invest in the resources that are going to be effective right now. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to see how those dollars are best spent when they're laying the foundation for change that may come in 5 years, 10 years. And that's why I think we need to focus more on, because that's a great example that you gave about the children of the epidemic are now our adults. People probably would not make that connection because that was so long ago. But we see it in why we honor our veterans who fought, you know, 50 years ago. These are people who are coming up after significant things happen. We need to be able to provide the access and the resources for them to be provided for. And so if we want to not only invest in youth, but again, like you said, I think when youth know we're investing in them, they're able to feel that empowerment. And so it's like, you know, when you get those calls from the Alumni Association, like, hey, can you reinvest? That's giving them the opportunity to reinvest, because they see how it benefited them when they were youth. And so as adults, they, again, where are they putting their dollars? Where Absolutely. Are they putting their vote? So if we really want to see impactful change, I think that's where we have to focus on, okay, we know we want to, you know, support law enforcement, but what can we do for these youth that will impact them 10 years, 20 years from now, which affects all of us?
Yes. And I want to stay focused, you know, on like, hey, we're working, because one of the questions I didn't answer was, what are we working to do to respond to people impacted by community violence? And we are working on a coordinated response plan that includes some violence interruptions, some having neighbors volunteer to support families individually impacted by gun violence, some messaging and marketing and broad community response, increasing the therapeutic options and opportunities, getting schools sort of meaningfully involved in the response. So we're working on a real coordinated response plan, ideally that it even includes increasing easier access and supports to people immediately in hospitals and medical centers. So yes, we hear that brought need for response. So I want to say that. And the thing that you mentioned, and in some ways I feel like we're going to go off the deep end, because one of the things that I feel like that we don't talk about is that longitudinal issue. Like, we had a crack epidemic. We know that it impacted people neurobiologically, brain development. Some of the things that sometimes look like ADHD were really responses to early cocaine and crack exposure, right? So we know all of that. However, as a community, society, child welfare, mental health service, even substance abuse providers, there was never a coordinated response to deal with crack. Educators never really came up with the intervention. When we had the meth crisis, there was a therapeutic, so child welfare had its own adaptive response, mental health had its own, there was a treatment protocol in substance abuse that was unique to meth. We're doing the same thing with the opioid crisis. However, it's almost like, right, this other epidemic existed that has huge long-term impact that we never talk about, and nor have we ever come up with a comprehensive solution to support people impacted by it. And so, kids who were taken out of their homes, I mean, how many children were involved in out-of-home placement? These are the same young men who, at 20-something, were removed from their parents and were raised by grandparents because the child welfare system interrupted because they view parents. But those disrupted relationships manifest as young men who may look like that they have problems with attachment, because legitimately they might have had multiple out-of-home placements. We know that statistically. Or that we know that they might have had some learning impairments because of how crack impacts the brain, that schools never responded to them. Instead, that they viewed them as problem behaviors or as kids who had learning or attention problems and medicated them, but didn't necessarily address the learning impairments, which make it difficult for them to complete job applications or to get into job training programs, right? So not addressing the solution leads to long-term problems, and I hope we don't repeat those patterns, right? Like, that we really think meaningfully about how do we see people and not just mask over the symptoms or criminalize the symptoms, but really to think about what do communities need to be promote healing both now and in the future, because all of these things are going to have long-term consequences, right? So, you know, a young man who is shot today or who dies today has extended family that needs support, might have children that need support, might have a partner that he's leaving behind that needs support. And how do we think about that whole village getting the support and care that they need, rather than, right, sort of just focusing on, well, we're going to arrest somebody and that's going to fix, right, this multi-layer system that is impacted and possibly broken because of the loss. I mean, it's loss of income sometimes. It's a loss of maybe that person provided some modicum of safety or stability. I mean, it just has this, you know, it's like a ripple effect that impacts such the village, and we need to be aware of those ripple effects on the village. And so we have, right, we're trying to plug in one hole in the dam, knowing that there are multiple holes of the dam erupting all the time, and we just need, what you said, the community to be patient, the community to stay involved and engaged, and everybody to sort of work in a much more collaborative response to address these issues.
I feel like we could benefit from just a session for the community just to understand that piece. Because, you know, as a therapist, one of the first things you do is ask about background. What's the history in your family? Why wouldn't we apply that same approach when we're looking at individuals in another setting? Because all of this is incredibly relevant. All of it's incredibly valid. You know, we always talk about how we want to get to root problems. That's, you know, what we always, we hear the million dollar questions of what are the root problems of this? Well, that's what you need to have an appreciation for, is understanding that the person that you see in front of you who's been involved in community violence, it didn't start yesterday, whatever this is you think is going on with this person. It probably started generations before, and now it's trickled down to this individual. And I think we lose sight of that so often because we want instant results. I think that's, you know, it's great what you said about the community being patient. We want instant results because we want that safety right now, and I completely appreciate that. But, you know, as people who worked in different environments and seeing that this didn't happen overnight, it's not going to unhappen overnight. You have to stay dedicated and vigilant with your support. I think that's the first piece of education mm-hmm. that we should have for our community is, you know, where these types of things come from. Because some people don't recognize that this is 20 years in the making.
That's right.
So any other things you want to plug for the coalition?
So the last thing that I want to say two things, and also remember dosage and intensity matter. So if you for young people and families with complex needs, they need a lot of support and resources, and we can't assume that once a week or a couple of hours a week are gonna be the it. So this requires a huge investment of mm-hmm. time, energy, resources. And if people only get a little bit and they needed a lot, right, use the medical intervention, we can't expect big outcomes of cures and fixes. So you get what you paid for.
Yes.
And so the last thing I want to say, though, is we really hope the community will come out and be involved with us at the Walk is One event on Wednesday, May 15th, on Trauma-Informed Care Awareness Day. Meet us at Salem. Bring your kids, bring your family, bring your community group, bring your organization. You can reach us at CUNeighborhoodChampions@gmail.com. We also have something on Facebook. So if you go to the coalition's website, Facebook, you can do that. And then the last but not least, we are organizing. We mentioned it, and we can talk about this longer. We mentioned that we will be having community forums after incidents of community violence. So we will be having a community forum this Friday at Jericho Missionary Baptist Church regarding the shooting that happened this weekend. And so it's primarily aimed at that area, but people should look again at the coalition website and to look at social media. We'll be, you know, issuing a major sort of call out for community people to join us in supporting the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, I think these are all great opportunities for, you know, those who are concerned about this in any way, shape, or form. The best thing to do is to be educated, understand the dynamics, understand how you can be involved. Because I know that's always somewhat of an overwhelming, you know, thought is how do I maximize, you know, the time that I invest in this? These are those events that you need to go
yes.
to find that out.
And as you talk, I was like, and I have one more pitch.
Sure.
So we have been, you know, begging, pleading individuals, organizations, and groups to be involved in our community response efforts. So if you know of somebody, if you see yourself as a volunteer who might be available to help support a family, we want to hear from you, so you can reach us at the Trauma and Resiliency Facebook page and send a message and let me know that you're interested in. We also are looking for organizations who might be willing to help us put together empathy boxes for families who've been impacted by gun violence. There are a lot of ways for you to be involved for a little time commitment or a bigger time commitment, but we need you and
yeah.
our community needs you.
And this really, you know, it would be great to see representation from the entire community, not just the regulars who are always there and show up. I think that's how we make this change, is when people see that the community cares about them. We start, when Pastor Carruthers said, you know, at a school board meeting, he said, you know, what we're missing is we need to put value back into people. And when people feel value, they're more, you know, the chances of them reinvesting because they, again, are pouring from a full cup now. That's how we do this. So, you know, at the very least, come out to one of these events. I will post the information on my Facebook page as well. But come out to the events, learn about what's going on in the community. And more importantly, learn about what it is that you're able to do, because that's so, so incredibly integral. Well, thank you, Karen, being on the show. We will have you on again because this obviously is a conversation that we have to keep going. if we want to sustain this kind of thing. So I will post things for the coalition. Definitely go on their website to check things out. If you have any questions, feel free to contact the coalition, and I'm happy to help you find information if you need any. Thanks again, and I will talk to you guys next week.
Tune to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. We are also streaming at weft.org, and you can find our two-week archive at Radio Free America. There's a link from the Listen Live page on our website. It's time almost for Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater, but I have just a couple of announcements before then. First of all, the time to get our Spring Pledge Drive shirt has been extended until May 14th. The original design from our resident artist, Ed Hadley, is now posted on the WEFT website at weft.org, but only until Monday, May 14th. So take a look and then click the support button to make your pledge. T-shirts will be mailed in the next few weeks, just in time for the warmer weather, and then you can wear your WEF t-shirt and be a part of the tribe. If you haven't made a donation, it's not too late. Go to our website at weft.org/support. That's weft.org/support. You can do it today. Know that every little bit is appreciated, and while you're there, check out the t-shirt and see if you feel moved to make a pledge at a level that will get you one of those nice critters. I've got a picture of it here, and it looks pretty darn, well, I think the only word for it is pretty darn metal. There's Wefty, our mascot, posing, flexing like a superhero with a radio tower doing kind of an electric lightning storm effect behind him. Also, please join us at 3 p.m. on Sunday, June 2nd, for a fun afternoon learning all about WEFT and what it takes to be on the air. Training is free if you are a WEFT member. For more information or to get a copy of the training application, email airshiftertraining@weft.org.